Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. This week on the program, we return literally to our beginning. In 2010, former Governor Eliot Spitzer was the first ever guest on the program, and he appeared again a few years later. He served as both New York State Governor and Attorney General and ran for New York City Comptroller in 2013. He now runs a real estate business in the city. Governor Spitzer, welcome back to the program.
It is a pleasure to be here, and I'm honored to have been the first and thrilled to be back.
Well, great. It's wonderful to have you. Well, I let's start by having you briefly bring our listeners up to date with what you've been up to since you ran for New York City Comptroller in 2013.
Well, I'm honored to have been able to step into the shoes of my dad, who founded what we call Spitzer Enterprises. It's really a real estate company that builds. We don't usually just buy and own. We build housing here in New York City, also some commercial properties in Washington, D.C., and in the Bethesda area as well. And I say I'm honored because I believe that building is good. It is progress. We build housing. We try to make a few bucks along the way, but it really leads to the organic nature of urban life. When we need housing, we build it. And I know there's much debate about the urban growth issues, as there should be. And having been in politics, obviously, I'm aware of all the tensions that arise when zoning issues arise and when scale and issues of how expensive housing has become arise. Very complicated issues, but we build housing and I'm proud to do it. And it's family business. And so I have the pleasure of having my brother and my sister as my partners. They're not active here day to day, but it's a real joy.
Well, that sounds great. So let me take you back to something and get you to look forward from it. But you were an early voice of warning about the financial crisis in 2007, 2008. We talked about that 11 years ago when we first talked. Curious to know if you see any new financial storm clouds on the horizon that we should be concerned about.
Well, there's the old cliche, and cliches, unfortunately, sometimes are accurate. The history doesn't repeat, it rhymes. And so the next sort of black swan event, if you want to think of the financial crisis of 07, 08 as having been one of those black swan events, may not be financial. It may have returned in the pandemic. In other words, there are shocks to our sort of social structure that we should have been more thoughtful about, should have been aware of. And pandemics are one of them. And so obviously this doesn't answer your question in terms of looking forward. I'll focus for a moment on the financial system itself. We do learn the lessons from history and have remedied some of the particular problems of that triggered the financial crisis of 07, 08 in terms of undercapitalization, the disconnect between risk and reward, the reality that back then people would make huge sums of money even though they had no capital at risk and therefore took outsized risks with other people's money. I've always said OPM is three most dangerous letters on Wall Street because they completely pervert the risk analysis that people with sound judgment should go through, and they didn't. So we've remedied some of those problems, and the Fed is very conscious of it, and the Treasury Department is conscious of it. Now, do I see the move towards sort of cryptocurrency as something that we need to worry about, the move towards significant sums of money flowing into the stock market without any apparent reason or logic behind it, leading to a roulette type of nature to the stock market? Yes, but then again, markets are designed to permit that and then unfortunately impose a penalty on those who are not smart. But I don't see the financial markets right now as being an area of tremendous concern. I think we are being reasonably prudent in how we handle them. But I think other areas are of concern. The pandemic is one. I think the issue of privacy is one, bizarrely, that I think we need to rethink. And I'm not sure this calls for substantial rewriting of the laws, but it's a conversation that we need to have as a society when we see what goes on in terms of hacking, both private and governmental. And that's not disassociated from the sort of systemic issues that we saw in 07, 08. And then, not to go on for too long, but I'd like to think we were ahead of the curve in a number of issues way back when I was in government, the other one being climate change, because in 1999, we brought the coal cases, what I call the coal cases, against coal burning power plants that were violating national statutes, but the underlying imperative was the inception of global warming and the threat. So that issues of equity, which are important to think about because gross inequity can trigger significant social discontinuities, which manifest itself in many forms. Those are the sort of structural issues that I worry about right now.
And let me shift now to looking at the politics of New York State. I think it's fair to say that the political balance in the state has turned more decidedly left than it was than when you were governor. Well, let me just check that. Is that your sense too, that New York State shifted more to the left over the last 10 years?
I don't think there's any question about that. And I would say if you step back and think about the reality that Governor Pataki, a Republican, was able to win three successive terms, and that's not that far back. And now I think it's fair to say the Republican Party in New York State is, if not moribund, appears to be asleep. Now, the other thing I would observe, and so yes, as an ideological matter, no question, the appearance is that we have moved significantly to the left because of issues such as equity, the reality that income distribution is something that is now discussed in a particular manner, as it should be. And again, we were ahead of the curve on that. The other thing I would add, however, is the pendulums swing much more rapidly than people think. And if you look at the New York City mayoral race as indicative of that, when that race began a year ago, perhaps, there was an assumption that issues of police misconduct and wealth disparities and equity issues would drive that conversation. And yet at the end of the day, the candidate who won, Eric Adams, won by talking about safety as being the preeminent issue. And so the pendulum has swung back more towards the center. That being said, I look at the decision about Amazon. Let me flesh that out. The decision not to extend to Amazon financial benefits so they could move its headquarters to New York City, because there was pushback against a huge company, one of the largest companies in the world, obviously, getting any economic benefit, as a turning point where people said, we're tired of giving benefits to those who don't need it. So yes, we've moved left. Things move more rapidly than we think, and the pendulum can go back more rapidly because the public is still centered on issues of growth, paying bills, and safety.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with former New York State Governor and Attorney General Eliot Spitzer. Well, let's look more specifically at this past year's state budget. It was, I think, especially controversial along the way. Do you think that the state is in danger of taxing itself to the point of doing some kind of real permanent damage to its desirability as a location for businesses and for high-earning citizens?
In New York State and New York City have a similar conundrum. We are high tax, and people will pay that tax, and here's the conundrum, if we provide the benefits to being here. People move here knowing we're a high tax state, or they remain here knowing we're a high tax state, and will continue to move or stay here if they perceive New York to be the intellectual capital of the world, the financial capital of the world, the cultural capital of the world, you know, the creative capital. I mean, there's a great book, The Creative Class, written a number of years ago that I thought captured at least one theory, I think a powerful theory of why urban centers have done well. We need to be that creative center. And so the question is, are people paying too high a price? If New York rebounds, and a year from now, theaters, restaurants, cultural centers, universities are once again spinning out the sorts of energy that they had pre-COVID, then we'll be fine. We can't raise taxes much more than we have. And I know a significant number of people, and there's a reality that Democratic leadership does not often want to accept, which is a very, very thin piece of the wealthiest number of New Yorkers do pay a very significant piece of the taxes. I know it's not an easy thing to run for office on, but that's a reality. So we don't want that universe of people. And they also fund cultural institutions, go to the restaurants, the theater. We need to appeal to that group that is important to our economic vitality at the same time that we derive our real engine of strength from immigration. And I don't just mean immigration from overseas, but immigration from the rest of the country. And not to go on too great length about this, but I have always said that New York will be healthy as long as we ask 20 college students, where do you want to move when you graduate? College students across the country. And if New York is on the list of 18 of them, we're fine. As long as college kids want to come here, because that's the future. I mean, it's not just some atmospheric sense. They really are the engine of growth. And that means we need to be affordable for them. And in an odd way, post-COVID, we are more affordable. Rents have dropped. And even though I'm in real estate, I say, hurrah, that's great. I'll make a little bit less money. But it means that kids around the country who had felt that New York was unaffordable are now saying to their parents, hey, I'm leaving. I'm going to New York. I can get an apartment for less. And that is what will be the engine of growth. So I'm an optimist in the long run, but we've got to be mindful of the fact that businesses can go to Austin or Nashville or Miami or Boston and other cities and do very well. So it's a balance. But yes, it's a balance we've got to be mindful of.
You mentioned Eric Adams earlier in our conversation, and I wanted to ask a couple questions about him. And as you noted, he was among the Democratic candidates, the more moderate choice. What will his impact, do you think, be on the city? And will he have any impact on the state's politics?
Well, the answer is merely by being elected, he's already had an important impact, because there was a statement made, I think, to the leadership of the Democratic Party that the move left had limits and that the voting public in New York City was very concerned with issues of crime, safety, quality of life, order in the streets. And we shouldn't forget that New York City has had both Rudy Giuliani and Mike Bloomberg as mayors in recent memory. And even though New York City is a Democratic city by a ratio of about 8 or 9 to 1, those who speak to those core values win in the long run. And so I think Eric Adams, by articulating that, has already sent that message. How effective he will be, of course, remains to be seen. And I think any citizen, and I happen to be a friend of his, I wasn't active in the race in any way, but I, as you might expect, having been in government, I knew most of the candidates. I'm a friend of his and wish him, as any citizen should, all the best and success. We want to succeed. So I think he now needs to, when it comes to policing, show the public that he understands both the need for law enforcement, and we need to drive violence down. The gun shootings that have spiked in the past year are unacceptable. You can't have, I say, no safety, no city. You can't have a city without a sense of safety. But he also needs to show an understanding to many communities that policing, and again, we were ahead of the curve. We put out the issue on the report on Stop and Frisk in 1999 when his attorney general began this conversation. You cannot have a police force that does not get along well with the community that is policing. It simply doesn't work. It's not healthy. And so he will need to bring a sense of balance to that. But if he does, that will be important. And I think he's begun to push back against some of the bail reform laws that were passed last year, that the perception is that they contributed to the uptick in crime. And there's certainly individual instances where certain defendants were put back on the street with no bail when they went out and committed other crimes. And so there is anecdotal support to that. Whether that is structurally the reason exclusively, it will take much more time to determine. But the politics of the moment suggest we need to be very thoughtful about how much more we liberalize bail reform, evidentiary decisions, et cetera, like things of that sort.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with former New York State Governor and Attorney General Eliot Spitzer. He now runs a real estate business in the city. Governor, when you ran for governor, you emphasized the need for ethics reform. That was an important part of your platform. I can remember that. Do you think the state has made any real progress on ethics since then?
You know, it's hard to know, and I sigh because I know that those who have the responsibility for taking a look at this have not really been appropriately vigorous. JCOPE, which is the entity that's supposed to inquire about propriety of actions within many of the state agencies, has fallen down in the job. And I'm not saying anything that is news or is a surprise to anybody. It has been unwarrantedly, improperly dominated by an executive branch that hasn't permitted it to do what needed to be done. And I think that record has been pretty clearly made by the few media outlets that properly look at it. The Times Union, I think, has done a superb job, and some other newspapers as well. I don't mean to slight them, but the Times Union in particular, I think, has focused on that, and properly so. And Jacob is fundamentally flawed. And the problem is, it's not flawed necessarily structurally, it's flawed because of the appointments and the intervention and improper intervention of the government, the executive branch in its deliberations, and the people who have been appointed to it were responsive to a governor rather than to facts. And the recent inquiries or lack thereof into leaks out of executive decisions by Jacob are merely one very small manifestation of that. Then you can go back to the story about the Moreland Act Commission that was appointed and then subverted and then eliminated. A horrific tale when those who have the pretense of inquiry with a sense of neutrality, in fact, are themselves are perverted. So I'm not comfortable with where we are.
What do you think holds the state back in this regard? I mean, you mentioned in the specific instance of Jacob the intervention of the executive branch, but it does seem like New York just perennially has a problem in this regard. Is it something about perhaps the tradition of politics in New York City going back to the 19th century? I mean, what do you think is going on?
Well, in a rare moment of appropriate hubris, I'll say I don't know. There were earlier moments in my life when I thought I perhaps had an answer. When you read history, the amazing thing is you realize that politics has always been like this. And so it may not be that this is abnormal. Our aspirations, obviously, are for much better. So it may not be that this is a deviation from the norm. It may be that this is the norm and we're simply failing to raise our performance level. It could be that there is a little less media inquiry, as the media has, and I don't say this to be critical of the media, but the media has gone more national, and consequently, we all know there's much less focus on the local matters, less opportunity for the inquiry that is needed to ferret these issues out. And somebody made an interesting observation, and it's not that I didn't really enjoy my time in Albany, but state capitals that are not also the media capitals of the states in which they govern tend to be backwaters and consequently don't have as much scrutiny applied to government action. And I think that's a reality. The New York City media spends a lot more time covering the mayor of New York than the governor. And so the sorts of things that happen in Albany usually don't get done here in New York City because there are more reporters. So those are, I don't know if those theories are correct or not, but we have some ground to cover certainly to improve our performance.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation about whether the state capital is the media center for the state. I hadn't heard that before. I have to think about that some more. If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is former New York State Governor Eliot Spitzer. Governor, you actually lived as a New York City resident through COVID, and I understand you got married during COVID, so congratulations to you. But how would you evaluate the state's response to COVID?
Let me begin by saying it's critiquing is easy, performing is hard, especially in a moment of crisis when one is making decisions on data that changes every day, which is what happened during the pandemic. And so the early flaw, and again, having said that, let me begin with where I think the error was. And this is at national level, where the federal response under President Trump really was, as we all, I think, know, seriously flawed. With the footnote that they got the private sector to generate the vaccine, which is the lifesaver for all of us. Other than that, they failed. The inadequacy of testing early on was, in my mind, one of the real failures. The state and the federal government should have been going out testing a broad enough sample of individuals from the very get-go so we could understand better as the days and weeks rolled by how broadly the virus had expanded and reached out to people, how many people were asymptomatic, how many people were having severe symptoms. We didn't have the database early on to understand the breadth and spread of this. And that need for testing continues even now, where we need more and more information to understand the appropriate response. And I would have, had I been governor, tried to get broad testing among state employees that they're willing to do, among the National Guard, volunteers, teachers, anybody, so we could understand geographically, demographically, what was going on. Put that aside. I think the nursing home issue is being investigated. And again, I don't mean to jump on one decision, but I think in hindsight, obviously, that was a mistake. And I think even those who made the decision acknowledge it was a mistake. And the stuff about data, I'll leave to investigators to determine what was done right or wrong in that regard. But that generated, obviously, unfortunate consequences. I think the response was too slow at the beginning. I think, and here's an instance where, and this has been properly critiqued, where the mayor of the city, of New York City, properly wanted more, a faster lockdown, and that was opposed, and the duration of that delay did have measurable and real consequences. But I say all these things with an appropriate acknowledgement that making decisions in the midst of a crisis is hard. Information is evolving, and you need the willingness to acknowledge error as facts change. So the good news is we are now where we are. We need to do a better job getting people vaccinated. There are still pockets of our communities where vaccines are somehow viewed skeptically. And I understand where that skepticism comes from, but my goodness, the only thing that will stop variants from continuing to spread real harm and danger is the vaccine. We need to get vaccinated.
You mentioned the nursing home scandal there, and before we were talking about ethics, I wanted to ask you this one question about Governor Cuomo, and it's just simply this. Were you surprised, or are you surprised that he did not resign?
I don't want to start opining about his resignation. Look, I'm probably one of the very few people who could meaningfully address that in certain respects, since I did. I think I did the right thing by doing so. I will say this. I think there are a number of very serious inquiries right now relating to him. And I think as a lawyer, somebody who's been a prosecutor, AG, I will let those run their course. I will say this. I would not have written a book about a crisis in the middle of that crisis, claiming victory when there is no victory to declare. I think that's a lesson that people should have learned from, if nothing else, mission accomplished with President Bush.
Let's shift to the national political scene. You've talked a little bit about it already, but how would you evaluate the Joe Biden administration so far? Again, you know, what's been done well? What do you think could be done better? And I hate to do this to you, but we've only got about another minute.
So all right. Look, I think
evaluate the Biden administration in a minute or less.
I'll speak quickly, which I tend to do anyway. Kudos to President Biden. He has remained popular, and that's important because we need to bridge the chasm between two political camps. Division was driving this country apart in a dangerous way. He has been a soothing influence. He passed a stimulus package that is working. He is trying through desperate efforts to work in a bipartisan way to get social reforms that are necessary to confront both the inequities in our economy while continuing the dynamic nature of our economy, confronting and resurrecting alliances globally that are important because this country continues to play the essential role of the voice of freedom and democracy. We were losing that role under Donald Trump because of his personal manifestations of autocracy. Joe Biden is returning us to our critical and historically important role as the leader of the free world. And that's the essence of what the presidency is about.
That was Eliot Spitzer. Governor, I always appreciate your insights, and I really want to thank you for taking the time to do this.
It is a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. Conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, is hosted and produced by Grant Reher and edited by Mark LeVonier. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program and to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/campbellconversations.